good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of September 6, 2015. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor for Technical Content at Information Week, and we are glad you're here with us. In the virtual studio, we have a great lineup. We have Information Week Executive Editor for Community, Dave Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
And we have Information Week contributor, Larry Loeb. Larry, thanks for calling in and joining us today.
My pleasure, Kurt.
Well, you know, I would love to start the conversation off with something else, but realistically, I think that we need to deal with the big, sleek, highly designed, and luxury-oriented elephant in the room and talk about what Apple had to say at their big event this week. So, Larry, I know that for a long time you have watched the world of Apple. In the pantheon of Apple announcements, where would you place what they talked about on Wednesday?
From a stylistic standpoint, there was a lot of shark jumping going on, in my opinion. If I hear the word amazing one more time, I may be incited to violence. The products were good, but 2.5 hours was way too long for this. I don't know why they wanted to present some fairly decent products in such an exaggerated venue. I wish they hadn't, frankly.
It is okay, true. Okay. You get to the point where you create these giant events and you puff up everything, and then what you're releasing is essentially an iterative product, a slight advance on what you had before. And we start getting to the point where we kind of wonder what all the fuss is about. It's different, let's say, you know, when Microsoft announces HoloLens, wow, that's a new product, a new thing, doing a new thing. Or when Apple announced its original products, they were worthy of a two-hour event. You kind of start to think, well, look, this isn't even the iPhone 7. This is the iPhone 6.5. And you just kind of wonder why it is that a slight improvement is worthy of censor.
The real announcement that they made got lost in all the kerfluffling. And that, in my move, is the iPad Pro. The convergence that Bill Gates talked about 15 years ago between tablets and laptops has finally happened. The iPad Pro, like in some ways the Surface Pro, is a capable machine for almost any use. Now, Apple being Apple, they made it into several parts. I don't think you can really use the Pro without their iPencil. What a horrible name. But their iPencil and their stand for it, so you can type on it.
So basically, you feel like whatever the price is, you need to add about $250 to take care of the keyboard and the pencil.
I think it's $350.
Well, it's interesting to me, and I have to say that I really enjoyed looking at the capabilities of the iPad Pro. As Larry said, it looks like an incredibly capable device. But to me, the little interesting thing was when Tim Cook just started out, when he called it the future of computing. And I think that is the big hint that was buried in there about the future of what Apple wants to do with its products. I mean, there's been all this stuff about the continuing relative strength of the Macintosh as a platform, growing, if very slowly, against the losses that most other manufacturers have. And the iPhone, which has become the product that Apple really depends upon for its big numbers. But it sounds like Tim Cook was saying that we need to look much harder at what's going on with the iPad in the Apple world, because ultimately that's where all of these things are going to converge. Now, do you think I'm reading too much into that, or do you think he was, you know, showing a bit of his hand going forward?
Well, I think you're exactly right on a number of points. The iPencil, to my mind, was the most innovative thing they showed. It could have been just a hunk of plastic working on a touch-sensitive screen. They made a fairly slick piece of engineering that allows different kinds of inputs to be done to the device that you cannot do on a keyboard. When you can tilt and draw at the same time, you've got something that the creatives are going to go mad over. It allows an entirely different kind of work to be done with that kind of device. It's got the technical chops, although I would really like to know how much memory is coming with it. Adobe seems, someone let out a promotional brochure that had 4 gigabytes as being the base memory on it. If that's true, that's a very good thing, because these type of files get very big, very fast. I think that, again, the convergence between what we call a laptop and what the iPad has been is getting very, very close.
Well, I agree with everything both of you are saying, but I think that's why Apple's making a mistake. So what we have seen for the last year is that tablet sales have gone down or have been flat, no matter what the manufacturer is. I believe the last number I saw was that the iPad was down 5.9%, and there were other manufacturers that were down even more. And it's my belief the reason for that is that laptops are getting more tablet-like, and phones are also getting more tablet-like. So the tablet is getting squeezed in the middle. We have found that the 10-inch, 12-inch tablet, while a fun device to read and watch TV on in bed, isn't as good as the kinds of convertibles that, like the Surface or like something like Lenovo's making with a Yoga, something that you can move and take apart and transform into a more useful device than a tablet. Seems to be the way the tablet world is headed. And while I see that obviously the Apple has added a keyboard to its iPad Pro, it hasn't done, in my opinion, as much with its actual MacBooks, which is, I think, the space that they're sort of dropping in, where I think they could have really stepped up. So I think by concentrating on the iPad, they're fighting the Surface, but they're missing out on fighting an awful lot of really good, really strong entries into what are still called laptops that, in my mind, are tablets.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that you say that. And I was just looking up something as you were talking, because it seems to me that an awful lot of these convertible devices, where they have gone wrong is by saying that all it takes to turn this into a tablet is essentially having a laptop computer where you can fold over the screen. Because most laptop computers weigh something between 3 and 4 pounds. And 3 to 4 pounds, after a little while, becomes a problem to keep in your hands, especially held up at an angle where you can use it all the time. I was really pleased that the weight of the iPad Pro comes in at just a touch under a pound and a half. I was looking up the Microsoft Surface Pro is right at 2 pounds. So it's an additional half pound. And while that doesn't sound like a whole lot, in your hand, at the end of your arm, when you're trying to hold it, that I think that does matter.
It matters, but I question how people are using tablets. I wish I had at my fingertips some data about exactly how tablets are being used, which unfortunately I don't have. But my general feeling is we're not using tablets at the end of our arm holding them in the air as much as we did even, say, 2 years ago. My impression when I see people is that the phone has gotten large enough that the kinds of things we were using tablets for when they were first invented, reading, mobile commerce, those sorts of things, are falling to phone-like devices. Phablets, if you have to use that term, which I hate, and that what we're starting to use our tablets for are work and home entertainment, neither of which require holding them up in the air. Now, I unfortunately can't prove that, but that's my general impression of the changing uses that the tablet's going through as the phone evolves.
Well, to me, one of the other interesting things about the iPad Pro is that it is, it seems to me, a very white-collar tablet. It is aimed, it seems, at the creative class, photographers, designers, people who make things look good. It's aimed at executives. It's aimed at various people who would use it often, just as you say, propped up on a desk, propped up on a table at a coffee shop, or you know, in an airport, doing work on the go. And the reason.
Oh, you mean the ones that could afford it?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's not a cheap device, and the reason I think that's important is because I see more and more tablets being used in what I would generally call blue-collar applications. When the air conditioner repair folks come to do work on one of my systems here at the house, they bring an iPad because that's what all of their paperwork is done on now. Their company has probably a couple hundred technicians out in the field, and each one of them now has an iPad that they use for doing everything from keeping track of work orders to swiping a credit card. I was in a retail establishment a little while ago, and the people going around taking inventory were using iPads. You're seeing tablets, and when I say tablets, I'm guessing that something like 3/4 of them are in fact iPads. The other is mostly Windows-based. I see relatively few Android devices in a professional setting. But these are devices that are being used by tradespeople, by salespeople, by folks in a blue-collar setting, and they need the smaller form factors. More than a phone, but less than the big, gorgeous, expensive iPad Pro.
You know, you're sort of leading out of the conversation here. Apple's secret weapon about iPads, and that's called Configurator. Configurator allows an iPad to be set up by an enterprise in a lockdown mode. It loads only the software the company wants on it. It can hard code passwords and VPN stuff right onto the iPad. For enterprise use, that kind of tool is just not out there for anything else.
I don't know if I would necessarily agree with that with a Windows product, but I would definitely agree with that with an Android product. I mean, Windows has had admittedly clunkier, sort of enterprise-ier versions of Configurator for quite a while. But you're right that there's an elegance to Apple's that's a little bit different.
Well, it's interesting. And the last thing, before we leave Apple completely, I want to turn to a couple of bits of older news and see if you think that these things play into the iPad Pro. And that's the relationship that Apple has built with IBM and the recently announced relationship with Cisco. Do you think that either of these, or maybe both of these, are going to be successful at pushing iPad sales into the enterprise? And if they do that, do you think they can drag MacBook and Mac sales with it?
I'm not sure Apple will cannibalize laptop sales to sell iPads. Again, I point to Configurator as a great way to get iPads into the enterprise, and especially with the newer models and the wide variance of price points that they imply, IBM, Cisco now have something to sell these people. If you're the CIO and you want a hot machine, well, we got your hot machine right here for you. If you're a grunt on a phone somewhere and all you need is something that displays virtual paper, we got that too. I think that's far more likely and explains the proliferation of the various iPad models, which has been one of the questions a lot of people have been asking. Why so many iPads all of a sudden? And I think that's the reason.
It might be true. I wonder, given the proliferation of incredibly cheap PCs, particularly laptops, and the enterprise dependence on Microsoft products as simple as, say, Link, there's so many enterprise Microsoft-level things that we depend on. I kind of wonder if anybody is going to open up their Microsoft shop just so they can use iPads when the Surface is starting to if not be as elegant as an iPad or as light, at least starting to, I think, compete. Before the Surface, I would have agreed wholeheartedly with that as a concept. The Surface is starting to enter this conversation. It's not there yet, but the Surface is getting close enough to an iPad. I wonder if people who are in a true Microsoft shop would care that much to change. But I don't know. Obviously, one of the things we know about consumerization of IT is that if your people demand it enough, you're going to let it happen.
Well, speaking of people demanding things, let's yield to what I'm going to assume is some demand for talking about something besides Apple. We're going to be talking about Apple off and on, certainly for the rest of the year. We've got lots more stuff coming up with the release of new operating systems and the actual rollout of the products and things like that. So first, let me ask the important question, did anything else happen in IT this week? Was anyone bold enough to do something else in the week when Apple was almost certain to be sucking most of the air out of the room when it comes to talking about announcements?
Well, Microsoft decided to stick its finger in Apple's nose by announcing partnerships with Hewlett-Packard and Dell to get the Surface out there. That was, to my mind, an apology to the other, to its partners, quote unquote, about doing hardware in the first place. They've got their way of pushing hardware out to counter what you were talking about between Apple, IBM, and Cisco. I'm not sure if pushing the Surface might cannibalize Dell's own tablets and HP's tablets. I think it very well might happen. But it does give them some piece of the pie.
Right. Well, and Dell and HP have been trying to get in the tablet market for ages, and both have failed pretty significantly. So I don't think they would be all that sad if they cannibalized that. I mean, think about HP going all the way back to buying Palm has been trying desperately to get into some kind of mobile something, and they just can't do it. And Dell had dalliances with Android and non-Android mobile devices at various points that never took hold either. So part of me thinking that this is also Dell and HP going to Microsoft and saying, we're sorry for flirting with these other kinds of mobile devices, as much as it is Microsoft apologizing to Dell and HP for making hardware. I think this might just be sort of I have a phrase I want to use, but we're a family show. I think this is just a makeup moment. How about we call it that?
With everybody sweating.
I think it's interesting that you refer to it as a makeup moment, and I think that's probably pretty darned accurate. I notice in the article that Larry wrote on this here at Information Week that Accenture and Avanade have also been named part of this. They're not going to be selling the hardware.
Just for the software.
Well, and I wonder, you know, you're talking about the software, but to me, the key piece is whether the professional services organization for each of these companies is going to be bringing the Surface Pro and the Surface into their accounts. And if that happens, because we tend to lose sight in the industry about these professional services organizations, which, you know, certainly in the case of IBM, and I suspect in the case of HP, actually are responsible for more revenue than hardware sales at this point. I think we lose sight of just how many units those professional services organizations can push, and that could be the key effort, both for the partners being able to have an end-to-end solution to go in without having to bring in another party like an Apple. And for Microsoft, it keeps everything in the family so that they are comfortable pushing the cloud services, which it's becoming more and more obvious are the future of the company. Am I smoking crack here?
No, there's one thing I don't know if you explicitly mentioned, and I think is a huge part of all this, is that both Dell and HP can provide service for the device so that the enterprise can not only buy the device, but get the service coverage it needs on one purchase order. I think that's a huge advantage.
That is a big deal, because that brings in the coveted ongoing revenue that pretty much everyone is eager to have these days.
And Microsoft, by the way, is having in the middle of a court case in New York City that could greatly affect the cloud and everything else we do. Microsoft, I wrote something about this, but because it's ongoing, there's no resolution. The Department of Justice wanted some information that Microsoft stored on a server in Ireland. The Department of Justice says we're not violating anything because the handover of information, no matter where it's stored, would occur in the U.S. Whereas Microsoft said, whoa, get the Irish courts in on this first pop-up. It's a huge case with huge implications. All sorts of people that you wouldn't expect, like the National Association of Manufacturers, are getting involved. They think that if the DOJ is allowed to do this, nobody outside the U.S. will deal with an American company. They may be right.
Right. Well, it's the same thing we've been saying about EU and the cloud and a lot of other things for a while. This is something that needs to be solved. And basically, you know, the internet, the network in general that makes clouds work, is borderless in scientific and engineering terms, but it crosses physical and national borders all the time. And this is a fight for what that means. Does the internet have borders? And if it does, then it changes not only the cloud, but it changes, even child pornography law. I mean, anything attached, really.
Well, it's interesting that our Department of Justice has basically come out with the concept that the boundary-less nature of the internet means that diction should be boundary-less as well.
Exactly.
And not everyone around the world agrees with them. So I hope nobody does, really. Yeah, I think that you're both right. This is something that some sort of international organization, and the U.S., it must be stated, doesn't really like international organizations to get involved in things like this. But this seems like the sort of thing that international organizations are going to have to solve, because some massive conflicts are on the way, and it will be interesting to see how those are resolved.
Right. But let's do take a moment to mention one negative side effect if Microsoft wins this case, which is that it probably creates a situation very similar to banking in the Cayman Islands or in Switzerland or something, that it can create a situation where countries could exist that you can store all sorts of information in to protect it and keep it out of the hands of the good guys, whoever those happen to be, much in the same way you can launder money in certain countries today. I'm not saying that that isn't something we shouldn't live with. I'm just saying that that is a side effect to saying, you know, that information in Ireland is secure.
Wait a minute. Anybody remember Sealand or a couple of Neal Stephenson novels?
Sealand, certainly.
Familiar.
Yep. Well, as with our previous conversation, I think this is one that has legs. We're going to be revisiting this for some time to come. And I'm looking forward to those conversations. This is the sort of topic that keeps those of us who call ourselves journalists employed for the long term. So good for the story. And we've reached that time of the show when we should turn our attention to, well, different matters. Dave, you and I were talking just before the show, and some interesting things are happening in the world of the Geekin. So tell us what has caught your eye for the end of this week.
Yeah, it's not up yet, but I just filed it. I think it's a pretty interesting story. A couple days ago, Elon Musk came on to the Colbert Show, the second Colbert Show, and predicted that we would have spacecraft that were reusable enough that spacecraft would become as cheap as airline travel is on the Earth within 2 to 3 years. Not coincidentally, I'm sure, the very next day, SpaceX unveiled its new Crew Dragon capsule, which, if they perfect everything that's involved, and they have not perfected everything yet, will be able to successfully, along with a Falcon rocket, launch a crew into orbit, take that crew to anywhere within Earth orbit, say International Space Station, come back and land not like a splashdown, like a Apollo mission, not gliding like a space shuttle, but under its own power to land with, as they describe it, the precision of a helicopter. Land on the ground, refuel, and go straight back up in the air again.
It's every 1950s science fiction movie I've ever seen.
Exactly. But it's what the space shuttle promised it would do in 1972, by the way. But we are getting closer and closer and closer to finally making that a reality. Now, there are caveats to this. The first is SpaceX has not successfully landed any of these things back on the Earth without a crash. But they are getting very close. The last one they tried hit the landing pad where it was supposed to hit, but hit it a little hard and broke one of its legs, and it toppled over and exploded. Had the leg held, SpaceX believes that it would have been safe. So that's an engineering problem people can get their hands around, versus, you know, some other sort of large things. We shall see. But there's real potential here for this becoming the first 100% reusable spacecraft. And if it does, we're talking about slashing the cost of space travel to probably a tenth of what it is today, meaning that commercial spaceflight tourism is soon to become a reality. And you can tell that SpaceX thinks they're close, because if you look at the capsule, and I've got pictures online in the article and video, if you look at the capsule, it is clearly a luxury model. It's a space limousine. And in fact, they even describe the chairs you will be sitting in as molded carbon fiber with high-end Alcantara cloth, and they talk about the window you're going to get to look out on the universe at. I mean, this is clearly designed to make you excited about getting in the thing, sitting in your chair, and going into space, as opposed to
Corinthian leather.
Yes, exactly. Not only did you say that, but I thought about it too. I have Ricardo Montalban mentioned in the article. And the fact that they're there makes me believe that they think this is achievable. And so they are going to do uncrewed testing next year and crewed testing in 2017. That's crewed EW, not UDE. and we could now the first test will not do the landing with propulsion. They will do a splashdown because they want to test the vehicle in stages. But it's possible that by 2018 we will have regular, fairly routine space flights and reusable rockets and capsules to the International Space Station.
And I wanted to mention that in addition to that, here in Central Florida, I'm in North Florida, but the papers in the last few days have had images of the launch pads that are being put together for crewed, again, EW, ED, launches for both SpaceX and the Lockheed Boeing Launch Consortium. They're putting, each of them is building their own launch facility there at Cape Canaveral. They're about 3.5 miles apart, the two launch pads, but both of them are going up, and it's interesting that each of them is using a similar approach. They're basically building the modules of the launch pad away from the pad and then trucking them in, because these are the same physical locations where they're sending up the unmanned missions now, and they don't want anything to happen in terms of a construction incident that would cut off the cash flow from the unmanned mission. So this is very much proceeding as a commercial venture on both sides of this, you know, wonderfully competitive manned spaceflight market that's in progress.
Right, and I think it's fair to say that it's proceeding with the assumption or the presumption of success, which is not how all space exploration, construction, engineering is done. And I don't think that's because they're being especially risky. I think it's because they feel like they're at a critical mass. The Dragon capsule that this is based on has been heading to space regularly since 2012. The Falcon rocket that they're using to do this has also been quite successful for roughly that time, although I will point out they recently had one explode on the way to orbit. So, you know, their space is still risky, you know. But the idea is that they now have enough experience that they feel like they're headed in the right direction. And I think that's a crucial difference from 3 or 4 years ago. 4 or 5 years ago, they expected that these tests of this capsule would actually happen in 2015. And they were pushed back slightly by some of the mishaps with the Falcon in its propulsive landing. But this is good because in the process, that's given them more time to work on the Dragon crew capsule. So I think that really we're getting close. And now I know people have been saying that for a long time, and people said that about other ships. I mean, we haven't heard about Richard Branson in ages, unfortunately, because of some setbacks with his program. So there are still things that can happen. And also, even after something gets into space, its reusability is another factor, right? When the space shuttle was announced in the 70s, it was assumed they would turn around in a month. And it turned out that most of them needed 6 to 9 months to turn around. They didn't have as long a life as we thought they would. Unfortunately, we lost some. It really didn't work as it was hoped it would work. But as Elon Elon Musk is happy to say whenever anyone talks to him, these are the only rockets flying in the world today that have been designed entirely in the 21st century. So he believes the lessons in the technology that have been hard won since the Sputnik, basically, are in this system, and that it should be reliable. So we'll see.
It's going to be an interesting one. And again, we are pleased to be able to say that this is something we get to talk about for a long time. And I, for one, am looking forward to it, largely because this is the kind of thing that I was promised as a child would be available for me by the mid-1980s. And doggone it, I'm ready for technology to deliver on these promises. I've been very patient, but patience is wearing
thin. Personally, I'm hoping that we can do one of these shows from space. I'd like to call in from one of these capsules on a show and tell you exactly what it's like.
But Kurt, you did get your hoverboards.
There you go. There you go. We do have hoverboards. We're getting closer. We're getting closer. We just need to have technology work, as Glenn Reynolds likes to say over at Instapundit, faster, please. Well, speaking of fast, that's the way our time has gone here this week on Information Week Live. We're glad you joined us. This has been, I think, it's certainly been an interesting show to be part of. I hope it's been just as interesting to listen to. If you're listening to us in a streaming on-demand format, we appreciate it. But remember that Information Week Live does happen live every week on Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'd love for you to be here to be not only listening to us live, but to be part of the online conversation that happens around the show. We'd love to have your voice in part of that. So go ahead and put it on your calendar. Plan to join us Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern. Now, before we go away, let me quickly ask each of my fellow panelists, what's coming up for the week ahead? Larry, let's start with you. What's on your radar screen for the next week?
Well, I've got a piece that's under embargo till the 17th, I think. Basically, it's about the survey someone did about wearables. There's some surprises in it, and I will say that you're going to be surprised at how much interest there is in watches, not just goggles or Google Glass, but watches.
Fascinating, fascinating stuff. So we're going to look forward to seeing that once the embargo comes off. And so that we know precisely when it goes live, how can we follow you on social media?
Well, my Tweety pipes are all the same. Larry Loeb, I got into the internet early enough that I grabbed my name and I've been able to use it. LARRY LOEB. You'll get a hold of me.
Well, we will certainly look forward to doing that. Larry, thanks for taking time out of a busy schedule to be with us today.
My pleasure, Kurt.
And Dave, it's time to turn to you. I know you tend to keep your finger on the pulse of all kinds of stuff around the industry. What should we be looking for from you in the coming days?
Yeah, well, look out for that SpaceX article. Also, it's already out. Please check out an article I wrote about Vint Cerf, the father of the internet, along with a few other people. He is looking for our help and reimagining the internet for the next few decades. I think it's a really interesting article. I really would like you to check that out if you haven't. I have a very different opinion of Apple Pencil, and it's going to be out this Sunday. And next week I have some articles on the best video games of the quarter, of the Christmas season, and also the state of contract work IT folks and how they're doing. That I think should be really interesting as well.
Outstanding. And as we ask everyone who shows up here on Information Week Live, how do people follow you on the Tweety Pipes and other social media?
Sure. You can get me at Geekend Dave. That's Geekend with a G instead of the W in weekend. And, of course, you can find me on Information Week and allanalytics.com.
Very good, Dave. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Kurt.
And as for me, I've got a piece coming up this weekend as well, looking at 10 great free programming tools for those who want to make the most of their development time without hitting their pocketbook. Look for that probably Sunday. That'll be coming out. Then this weekend, I'm heading down to the Orlando Maker Fair. So I'll certainly have a slideshow on that coming up next week, see what all the makers are doing out there. This one should be fun. If you want to follow me, you can do so on Twitter at KG4GWA. I'm on Instagram, Kurt.Franklin. You can find me on Facebook and on LinkedIn at Curtis Franklin. Well, again, for Larry Loeb, Dave Wagner, and everyone here at Information Week Radio, we thank you for listening. Wouldn't do it without you. And we'll look forward to being with you next time here on Information Week Live.